MDM is a farce. Company issued phones are worse. Everybody who has a company issued phone doesn't use it. They use their real phone when they're at the pool. But the company has plausible deniability because they told them to use the corporate one. It's not real security.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back everyone to the Adversarial Podcast. Got Sunil Yu and Mario Duarte here, as always with me, Jerry Perullo. Hey guys, welcome back. It's Black Hat's over now. I got one bit of congratulations I want to say, but first I want to ask, Sunil, you were there. Did you manage to avoid COVID?
Yes. Well, no. I didn't manage to not avoid COVID. I'm sure it was prevalent everywhere, but for whatever reason, I didn't catch it.
You managed to survive it. That's amazing. Good. Well, it's really convenient because you, congratulations, you won the Black Hat startup competition with Nostic. That's pretty awesome.
It was a lot of fun. You're given a 5-minute time frame to pitch, and you know I've presented many times over, and I thought, okay, four minutes 30 seconds, I got it down. I blew past the time.
Oh, it wasn't the type of thing where the hook comes out and they make a noise or anything.
And they cut the time, yeah. And I didn't realize how you don't until you're on stage. You don't really understand how time moves when you're under such a high pressure scenario.
Well, I mean, hopefully it didn't hurt you too much because you emerged on top. That's awesome. Good for you guys.
Yeah. And Sunil, the word on the street was that it was a very unique product that people hadn't seen. So congratulations, friend.
That's tough.
Yeah, thanks.
That's tough to say these days, so that means something.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Standing out is hard in the midst of all the noise that we hear. So, yes.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, let's jump right into it. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there was any major geopolitical cyber event in the last week or any new major breach, but man, there's no shortage of ongoing issues. The one that I know got my attention a lot was the National Public Data breach. And that's, you know, it's been brewing for a little while now. And for the layperson, that's the headlines that you saw of hackers got the most Americans' social security numbers. That's kind of the quick of it. And since then, you know, over the last week, there's been a few sites that came out that took the – I was describing it to someone recently, and I said it's like Napster or LimeWire or wherever you used to get pirated movies and music. That's where you can get the social security numbers now. Like it's out there. It's not hard to get to. It's not deep and dark web. And so a few companies put a front end on it, right, where you can put in your name and say – and it shows you, and it'll mask out some of it, but boom, it's there. And I know I went through that, and immediately it was like, man, not only does it have my info, but it has it like 10 times over. I almost want to reach out to them to clean it up a little bit because it's just too messy. Help polish it up. When I saw that and I look at it now, first of all, every time there's a data breach, everybody starts sending emails about credit monitoring. Which to me is just awful, right? These people are already on their heels. What should they be worried about? Identity theft. And then they start getting these unsolicited emails with links to click. It's just awful follow-up. My conclusion on that whole thing, ever since the Equifax days, was just to freeze credit on the big three and call it a day. And that's been my advice to people all along. Are you guys in the same boat?
Well, I lost my identity. My identity was stolen back in 1996 or 5, I think it was. Back then, police had no idea what this was even about. Like, what does it mean your identity was stolen? What do you mean this person is opening library accounts on my behalf or phone accounts on my behalf or all these things? It's kind of crazy. So I dismissed my social security number as a private number. Mm-hmm. Since 1995, I assume that's a public number. You know, it wasn't that public, but the point being, it's public. Unfortunately, we still have a lot of folks who depend upon it being a private number, and I think that's the fault. That's the faulty aspect of the threat model or the assumptions that we make about that piece of information.
You know, I'm not picking on millennials or Gen Zs or anything, but you know, the whole idea that your Social Security is private, that pipe dream died a long time ago. So on generations, millennials, I have a friend whose kid turned 21 recently. Maybe it's Generation Z. Anyway, this just goes to show you, I don't know what generation I'm talking about. But anyhow, his kid goes ahead and posts her driver's license on it was either Facebook or Instagram, and it had her driver's license number, date of birth, her address, and says, hey, I'm legal now to drink. So, the whole concept of stuff like that, it goes out the door, man.
Well, the way I see it, like kind of your point, Sunil, about kind of giving up on it, I mean, we know from the behind the scenes, right, from corporate security and running enterprise security groups, how much money is, I'll say, wasted on protecting maybe not PII as a whole, but certainly SSNs. I mean, the world invests a portion of GDP on spinning in circles pretending we're protecting the SSNs. And I think the frustrating bit has been that we all know it's really easy to get any SSN on the if you're a bad guy. So all we do is make it harder and harder for the good guys to actually use them. So when I saw these sites that basically now are saying, you know, anybody could get to this data very quickly, mm-hmm. I thought this is kind of good news, right?
Yep.
So I've joked about putting mine on my LinkedIn profile, right? SSN colon is bang the damn thing out. Because either I'm protected against that with my credit freezing, in which case, who cares? Or I'm not, in which case, putting it on LinkedIn doesn't make things any worse because the bad guys all have it.
Well, Todd Davis, who was the CEO of LifeLock, if you remember, he put a social security number on billboards as a part of advertising LifeLock. And let's just say that at some point in time, he said, let's take those ads down because it didn't go so well for him. I think your point is still valid, which is we have the really bad thing about trying to keep security social security numbers private and secret is that there's a false sense of assurance or a false sense that we're doing something about something that is actually already widely exposed. And therefore, if we have any system that relies upon social security number for being secret, then we can blow through that threat model, part of that threat model, and say, look, that's a bad assumption. You have clearly things like the national public data that just says we need to rethink that part of the threat model.
Yeah. I mean, I want to go back to what Jerry's saying, be a little bit adversarial. I would, first of all, credit freeze is step number one, okay, on all three of the major credit monitoring companies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that unfreezing of your credit, maybe your credentials were compromised and the attacker unfreeze your credit, right? And so now not having monitoring enabled to alert you if new credit has been established or created, you might be blind. You might not see it. So credit monitoring is not good enough. You have to do credit freezing, but you want to keep the credit monitoring, make sure nothing has gone awry.
Yeah, so as mentioned, I've my identity has been stolen since 95. So the whole notion of credit freeze is something I've been very well aware of for the last almost 30 years. I'll tell you, the first 15, 20 of those years, it was a real pain getting credit. Why? Because my credit was frozen. Getting new credit meant that I had to call and say, hey, please unfreeze or these are legit. Nowadays, some of the tools have apps, have a web interface where you can unfreeze, and so on and so forth. Now, to Mario's point, I think it should be like what we have with credit cards to some degree, where I can lock a credit card when I feel like I'm not going to be using it for a period of time, and I'll unlock it when I feel like I'm going to use it. But it's all within my direct control. In that same way, we would want something like that for our credit, too. So an app from Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax, or maybe an app that crosses all three. So I just press it once and I'll freeze it. But when I actually am going to apply for a credit card or do something, I unfreeze it just for that point in time. And then Mario, to your point, if someone somehow breaks in and freezes or unfreezes something on my behalf, then I get some alert that says, hey, you just did this. Are you sure that's, didn't you know it was you or not?
Yeah. I think look, the best way to protect something is to burn the secrets. And I do think just having them out there, and there's got to be some point where we can acknowledge the fact that those are not, unique identifiers.
Yeah. So here's a consideration, too. At the same time, we need unique identifiers, right? We need a national ID of some sort. But we need a different model for how we think about the issuance and the preservation of these national IDs. I remember when during the Afghanistan withdrawal, we had all these refugees coming in, and the U.S. needed a system to quickly issue them an ID. And what did they do? They actually gave them an ephemeral ID, which I think was wonderful. I mean, it's an idea around, you know, the pets and cattle analogy I've talked about in the past. Because if at some point in time they lost it and need a new ID, there's a way to reestablish it and say, okay, here's your new national ID. If you want to give that out to other people, go for it. But at some point in time, we can, if we want to nuke it, get a new national ID.
Yeah,
that'd be nice, right?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at it from a cybersecurity vantage point, the idea of social security numbers were pre-single factor, right? They were the original single factor. I mean, at least you have a username and password. One could argue that's two factors. You got the username and then the password. Social security was everything bundled into one, right? It's a unique identifier, and it's serving as a password. So, of course, we ran all these problems. And we're all, you know, beating drums all the time about multi-factor, dynamic, cryptographic authenticators, and we expect this monolithic single thing to still work. I mean, it was only a matter of time. It's a symmetrical...
You know, Medicare... Yeah, and Medicare numbers, if I distinctly remember, I used to be in the health industry a long time ago.
Oh, sorry.
Medicare numbers were actually Social Security numbers.
Yeah. It was on the insurance card.
I mean, think about it. It goes in your mail. You generally go in the mail. You have somebody break into your, you know, looks into your mailbox, and they would grab, oh, there's a Medicare something. Sure enough, there's Social Security stuff. And then you can, you know, charge the government for things that you never done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, joking aside, the reason I do joke about publishing all these things is going back to the cost. You know, when I think about building product to protect Social Security numbers, the right thing to do, and I don't think a lot of people are doing it, was tokenization, right? Because you can't hash, you can't do anything deterministic because it's a very small amount of space. It'd be easy to brute force it. So you've got to basically swap at random generated values and then keep that ultra secret. And how good are we at keeping a certain database ultra secret, right? That's challenging in itself. And then have, if you actually want to be able to do, like I worked on a big, on a very relevant application, the Consolidated Audit Trail. That was a mandate from the SEC that said, we want all these broker dealers to be able to tag all the orders and deals that people are doing on various little brokerages. So we can have in a central database indexed with a unique identifier, like social security number, so that when a stock pops right before an announcement comes out and it looks like someone's on the take, we can know exactly who put in the buy orders. Because right, otherwise they'd have to kind of subpoena it all the way down flow. And so we, for some reason, got kind of tripped into building that system. And we went through this tokenization. And I remember on the whiteboard in the room for so long to come up with this model and how's the data flow and how are we going to let some of these numbers stay at the broker-dealers and not flow uphill and all that. And if we just admit that the Social Security numbers are not good enough, then we just saved millions. We can just get over this already.
Jerry, you know, it's interesting. And look, so if everybody has their Social Security numbers and they can match it up to your name, and you're the your company X, and you're spending all this money to make sure you're protecting PHI or PII, whatever, right? To your point. But, you know, imagine if you receive an email, your HR department gets an email sent by an attacker that says, I have Jerry and Sunil and all your employees' Social Security numbers. Right? The idea is they've already breached. Well, folks, all you have to do is go to LinkedIn, pull out all the names of that company, employees, match it up to these, you know, databases that are publicly available, match it up, and send it to somebody's company and make them all sweat that they've been compromised.
Oh, no.
No, seriously, right, Jerry? I mean, that's kind of
your
point.
I'm glad you brought it up now because that's going to happen, and I hope somebody listened to this first and said, I know what's going on here. Mario tipped me off. Yeah. No, in a good way. You're going to save people a lot of panic if they're like, oh, this is what Mario predicted. As opposed to, yeah, because you're right. Otherwise, it's spooky as hell. Yeah. All right. So who's publishing their Social Security number tomorrow? unfortunately, I don't think you can rely on all the companies that are using it today to actually get the memo and actually update things, you know? All right. So what else are we going to talk about? I think our old favorite perennial topic of banning ransomware payments is up. So there's a story here where it came up recently that there was a target, a victim of ransomware that was, because there's some local bans for government entities to pay ransom, and one of them was the case in Miami here, I guess, and they were not allowed to pay the ransom. How do you guys interpret this article?
Well, I think my earlier comments about whether it's going to be feasible in the long term is questionable. But I would say, let's consider another way to think about this. The ban here is more so a statement that says, we prefer you to rebuild your system than to try to pay off somebody. Okay. In other words, we find more value in you having a greenfield initiative to rebuild a system that is down right now, rather than trying to bring it back up. Okay. And if that's the case, and by the way, I generally believe that sort of pressure is a great thing to have. Maybe a BCP is that sort of, if you do a BCP exercise, maybe that's the exercise one should do. Like, how quickly can you actually recreate this whole thing rather than trying to pay, you know, resuscitate a dead horse, so to speak. So if that's the decision that this drives towards, then I think we'll be all the better for it.
I don't have a lot of faith in politicians. Please forgive me, anybody who's listening on this, my apologies, but I just don't, right? And so I did check out the video, one of these videos for the local news outlet talking about this problem. And during the outage, I think it was 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, there were people complaining, small businesses complaining, I can't launch my business. I cannot do my restaurant. And well, that may not seem like a big deal to us, but I think if you have enough folks complaining, one about it, or the right, you know, business with the right influence getting popped, with the right influence with politicians, they're going to start complaining. And next thing you know, you're going to say, well, this thing is starting to impact my local economy. And as a governor or a local politician of that place, anybody who starts associating my new laws with impacting growth, economic growth in our country, I think they have too weak of a backbone, and they're going to ban, and they're going to get rid of this.
I'm willing to give it a try still. Because when I read about this and somebody, and the story, you might interpret it as, look at the hardship people endured because of the ban. And I don't look at it at all. I say, look at the hardship people endured because of ransomware. Because look, if there was no ban, probably still be down for a week.
Actually, let me rephrase it slightly differently. Look at the hardship that people endure because we allow these pet-like systems to perpetuate. These pet-like systems, which include things like our social security numbers, mm-hmm. that live for a long time. And we try to resuscitate them every time they get breached. Okay. Versus, well, you know what? We should consider this system to be dead. These social security numbers, the North Miami systems, they are dead. We move on, and we design from scratch from that point forward. Anyway, that's what the ban. That's one interpretation of what the ban is implying.
Yeah.
Here's another way to think about it. What if I said from henceforth we ban the use of social security numbers as a private identifier?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're going to have to do that if you're going to be able to publish it. Because the reason that guy got burned after putting on the billboard wasn't because he was wrong about locking it. It was because there were a bunch of vendors who weren't playing ball.
Continue to use it. Right. So in the same case with North of Miami, they pay the ransom. Now they are able to fall back and say, oh, guess what? We can continue to use these antiquated systems that will get compromised again. Or an antiquated design that can be compromised again. So now you're forced to think differently about, okay, how should we design this to be not disruptible in the future?
First off, I don't think government agencies, last time I checked, have a lot of money, especially local agencies, to be able to say,
agreed.
We'll start all over again, switch from those systems and redo it. I just don't think we have the money. We're struggling already with, you know, I don't know tax collection, whatever that looks like, but it has to come from somewhere. And quite honestly, you know, we haven't designed government to be fast, to react fast to these things. So I just don't know, Sunil, how that could happen. I mean, I'm just, you know.
Yeah, I'm in the middle. I agree with you, Mario, where I don't think it's plausible to have a rising tide, to just do quality at scale. There's going to be a lot of companies that just don't have the resource and are going to do a crap job of it. But I still think we should ban the ransomware payments anyway. Because I mean, the incentive model that you painted there, that an attacker says, well, let's just hit them all anyway, because if we hit enough, they'll write their congressman. And ultimately, they'll change the law. That's a lot harder to monetize, you know, for a fencing operation, so to speak, than where we are today, which is let's just hit them and their stuff won't work and they'll pay us. So I'd rather, I mean, at least put some distance between the two things, and they're going to have to write their congressman and prevail on them. And if you're right and they unturn the law, then so be it. We're just back to where we are now.
So let me offer another counter to, can a small government like this spin up a whole new service, whatever. Well, that's what SaaS is called, right? That's what SaaS is for. Like, I don't know what this, I have to go and look in detail into what these North Miami systems look like. But if that was a custom-built solution for what is a common service need across many organizations, many governments, then they're probably doing it wrong.
Mm. You mean go to a cloud provider and expect that they will, you know, provide you with all the security already built in and hardened for you, and then your employees may not be as familiar with those, you know, cloud environments, and goodness, I can't make this application work that used to work before. And next thing you know, they start opening things, misconfiguration happens, and that veneer of security in those cloud providers disappears.
That's right. You know. That's right. It's easier to misconfigure, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But it's probably I would rather have a misconfiguration problem than an unmaintained system problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what's next year? On the topic of misconfigurations, so there were at least two headlines in the last week. Look, these things about AWS configuration issues, there's a million riffs we could take off of this. I'll kick off about, I've been saying for years, I think enterprises should not have vulnerability management departments. I don't think that they should have people with vulnerability management in their title. And the reason is, I think vulnerabilities are an overrated slice of risk. And when people myopically focus on vulnerabilities and patching and all that, that they're not looking at configuration issues, which I would argue have similar traits as far as the researchers find them, just like they do vulnerabilities. They publish them. The attackers weaponize them in mass, look for them all over. It's the exact same thing, but that's not in the vulnerability management team's remit, and you just wasted a bunch of money. So I think vulnerabilities are just part of risk management that should be broader, and that configuration issues need a lot more attention. And that to me, that's what these headlines are saying.
All right. Well, so first of all, let me push back on that. CVE, mm-hmm. vulnerability and exposures. One can argue that E is the configuration part of the CVE. So first of all, let's now consider, what's the difference between a vulnerability and configuration? Well, I would argue there is a distinction, and the distinction is important to recognize. When it comes to a configuration, is a configuration good or bad? Well, we don't know. It depends. It depends on context. Is a vulnerability good or bad? It's bad. There's no context needed to know that a vulnerability is bad. Okay, so in other words, to know if something is bad requires some context for configurations, but doesn't require context for vulnerabilities. The question as to whether we do something about it requires additional context, which both need. So in other words, a configuration requires context to know if it's bad, and requires additional context to know whether you should do something about it. A vulnerability is bad by default, and then it requires context to know if you do something about it. The do something about it is the management part of it. You know, it's the risk management part of it. But the first step in just knowing is it good or bad, and that's where the research comes in, just as much as researching vulnerabilities, okay? But the reality, again, is that not all configurations are bad. That said, within the context of secure by default, or secure by with the whole secure by design principles, there are some configurations that should be set in such a way that you don't shoot yourself in the foot. And if it turns out that 99.9% of the time a certain configuration is bad, then maybe we make that secure by default. So S3 buckets is a great example. I don't know what the actual percentage is, but I would probably think 90+% of the time, having them open to the public is a bad thing. So AWS at some point said, well, anyway, but the point is that there was enough bad problems that emerged from misconfigured S3 buckets that now, instead of you having them open by default, you have to open them by exception.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, you're right. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I know they warn the hell out of you right now when you do it. However, then there's a million tutorials out there that says how to spin up your first website, put your static content in an S3 bucket, mm-hmm. and it basically says click open, click OK, click yes, I agree, click yes, I signed this waiver, just ignore all the stuff, go right through it. So it is complicated and confusing to people still.
Or download your favorite Terraform script that's being used by everybody. It has all these share keys that everybody, hey, I was just testing it out.
Yeah.
In prod.
You'll go back and fix it later. Don't worry, right? You'll tighten it up later.
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah.
You know, so I think maybe we talked about this a while back ago on the podcast that we did. But, you know, I actually went and looked at major data breaches that have occurred in the last 15 to 20 years. Publicly, major data breaches, a million records or more or greater. And the vast majority of these data breaches were not necessarily vulnerabilities. I think Jerry's right. Okay, I think Jerry's right. It does get a lot of attention, those vulnerabilities. It does, and we put so much energy on it. It turns out that it was misconfiguration. So Sunil, yes, there's got to be some configuration setting that's approved by the company or generally accepted configuration, but human beings make mistakes all the time. And whatever happens with that configuration, something you unintentionally or intentionally did as an employee with elevated privilege, misconfigure it, and then thus allow an attacker to exploit it. That's what we see mostly.
All right, so let me offer, there may be more quote configuration errors, but let's look at it from the attacker standpoint for a moment. Mm-hmm. I scan for a vulnerability, I know it's bad. Okay, well, again, whether it's significant and so on, that's a different question. But if I scan for a vulnerability and there is a vulnerability as an attacker, I'm like, ooh, great. I now have a vulnerability to exploit. If I look for a configuration and I see, like, let's say, an S3 bucket's public, as an attacker, I'm like, maybe that was intentional, or maybe it wasn't. And now I'm putting burden on the attacker to make that decision to say, oh, I found something juicy or I didn't find something juicy at all. And in the context of public S3 buckets, as an example, actual public S3 buckets, 99.9% of them are probably open by intention, right? So now the attacker has to find that one little small percent that is not open by mistake, and they have to sift through and find that one actual configuration error, okay? So I do want to recognize, yes, there are many configuration errors. There's many ways to shoot yourself in the foot. But keep in mind, the reason why attackers have trouble finding these configuration misconfigurations is partly because they're having to make the determination as to whether it actually is a misconfiguration that creates an exposure.
But there are some telltale signs, though, right? I mean, there was 2, 3, 4 years ago. If I think all of us look at, have I been pawned before? And then you look at all the top 5, 10 breaches in the last year, right? Or last 2 years. And there was a group, there were supposed to be security researchers that made a living out of this. And then what they would do is they would scan people's AWS accounts to see if their Elastic database was publicly accessible. And they say, oh, you know, that's publicly accessible. And what they found was most people thought, because there was in the confines of the security group behind AWS, this Elastic database was never going to be publicly accessible. But somehow, some engineer in that company would open up the security groups and allow it publicly accessible. However, the Elastic database password was administrator and often no password or password. Administrator password.
What's the CVE on that, Mario?
Exactly.
Sunil, like to your point, first of all, I'll posit that bug bounty activity is very similar, and you can map that to adversary activity, and that as a result, with full transparency, we have a pretty good model to a simulation, if you will, of attacker activity and what they do. And I can tell you, operating bug bounty programs a long time, you don't get a lot of CVEs off of that. I mean, you get some every now and then. But that's just low-hanging crap that's gone, right? Where are they making their bones in IDOR, in Burp Suite, right? In looking at application logic. Also default freaking passwords, debug flags that are still turned on in prod that are dumping memory stacks, all that kind of stuff. And I don't think it's a far stretch at all. It stands to reason that as an adversary, that's what people are doing as well. And I feel like, you know, the teams and the resources and the money that's being thrown and sometimes mandated, I think myopically by regulation at times about what's your vulnerability management, what's your vulnerability management. Everything I just described isn't fair game for that. Vulnerability management is all about patching crap. And the worst part is all those programs are running from the inside out. They're running with privileged agents on everything. So they start with millions of vulnerabilities, 99% of which aren't exploitable to the outside. And if you got infinite resource, that's great, but that's taking from the plate of the people that should be looking for insecure direct object reference from the outside tomorrow.
Okay, but I think you're talking about two different types of vulnerabilities here. When we talk about CVEs, we're talking about the traditional vulnerability management from a device-centric view. You're talking about like Windows vulnerabilities or well-known applications and so on and so forth. But when you're talking about, let's say, web applications, which are all, you know, custom, idiosyncratic, those vulnerabilities are still, you should treat them like a Windows vulnerability. It's just that because you don't have as wide of a concentration of deployment, the point is that you don't have, you won't have a CVE, but it's still the same kind of, quote, vulnerability versus, let's say, a configuration, if that's what you were suggesting it was.
I agree fundamentally, but I would just put it opposite. Instead of saying that you should treat those like vulns, I'm saying you should treat vulns like those. And the same team should be running all of them. And even if it's a red team firing or anything else like that.
Well, actually, I have a general premise that whether it's a device or an application or a user, that your, quote, vulnerability management team should look at all those collectively and say, how do we process these, quote, exposures and vulnerabilities in a systematic way? So in other words, you have an Active Directory administrator that clicks on phishing emails all the time. As far as I'm concerned, that's a critical 3-day remediation vulnerability. You send that AD administrator to some you know, phishing awareness training to make sure that they don't
detention center. Again. I thought you were going to say.
Yeah.
Yes.
I really like what Jerry's point is on this vulnerability management, right? Sorry.
I was going to hope you were going to say that.
yeah. No, there's sometimes I agree with you. Other times I don't. 50-50.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going to upset a bunch of auditors. My goodness, I'm breaking every law here for customer or listeners. I think we're focusing on the wrong thing when we're doing vulnerability. The reason I think we're doing that is because it's really, as an auditor, it's easy, mm-hmm. in my opinion, to go look at a system and say, what's vulnerable, what hasn't been patched, and how long has it been, it's taken to be patched. I think it's much harder to say, of those libraries, what are being actively used and actually impact your environment. Let me give you another example.
Totally.
Most public companies have to go through user access reviews, right? I think we've all done that, right? User access review as part of SOCs, and they go through all, well, and when's the last time that employee logged in? And when's the last time the password changed? And do you know when that employee left the group or the company? And so they put all that energy there, okay? Good enough? Awesome. But there's all these other long-lived tokens that are used by applications or scripts or workload to workload that are accessing the same financial systems. But guess what? Those auditors are not asking, when's the last time you changed that token or that password for that workload?
We have. I mean, service, yeah. There are some auditors that have wisened up and said, hey, how are you managing these service accounts?
They're starting to, Sunil. You're right. Mm-hmm. They're starting, like some auditors are starting to be a little bit more like, hey, okay, those patches that you're having, I mean, what libraries are actually being loaded? So I think there are some that are doing it, but it's not the norm, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were also saying something I want to just go back and recharacterize again. I mentioned configurations requires one level of context. What we do about it, both vulnerabilities and configurations require context as well. So that point that you made in terms of just because you have a vulnerability, just because what you think is a misconfiguration is a misconfiguration, or configuration is a misconfiguration, doesn't necessarily mean you do something about it, right? We may choose to ignore many of these things just because no impact, bigger fish to fry, whatever else it is.
And that's why they're risks and not vulnerabilities.
And that's why we call it management, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what we're actually managing. We're saying we can't fix all these things, so that's the management process itself.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
Well, so I'll pause it out there. Adversarial statement, right? I don't think patch metrics belong in a boardroom. Full stop. And it's tied to what we're talking about. It's because it's not the fact that it's a vulnerability. It's the fact that it's exploitable, that it's a risk. I think if the lack of patching is leading to actual exploitable issues, that should manifest in some kind of metric that goes in the boardroom. Sure. But patch metrics, what a waste of time. I see all the time. We're at 83% patching. Oh, how do we get that to 94? We spend more money, hire them, throw money at it, pull it right out of the shareholders' pockets. Let's go. For nothing. It's a big waste of time.
So let me give you an analogy that I oftentimes think through here. I mentioned earlier, we do vulnerability. We look at vulnerability management. We should do it across devices, apps, and I've mentioned users as well.
Yeah.
A user has a vulnerability, and what do? You patch the user. The patching of the user we call training, okay? So let me now, to Jerry's point just a moment ago, is training, look how many people we trained. Is that a board-level metric?
No.
Does HR ever say, hey, here's how many people are trained? You're like, why are you telling me this?
And how many people fell for that phishing, simulated phishing attack?
Okay. That you'll see every time.
My point is that the notion of, to Jerry's point, we may not put training, nobody may put training as a board level metric because the board's like, why do I care about who's taken what training? However, there may be a certain outcome that we're trying to achieve. Right? For example, we rolled out a new product, and we've now trained up X number of people. We've enabled X number of people to now be able to sell that product or use that product or whatever else it may be that's driving revenue in some way. Board may care about that, but it's not training specifically. It's about some sort of enablement.
Yeah.
Or risk reduction in this case for us.
And to tie it all together, so you're going to think I'm digging this out from a whole 48 seconds ago. But when you're talking about user access reviews, right? And you talked about it to say like, and you're talking about token and like ephemeral identifier auditing versus the actual credentials. And then we got into service accounts and all of that. But I remember getting either qualified or almost qualified audits because of that, right? Because to your point, that's what they myopically focus on because it's one thing they could do. And give me a list of people in HR, give me a list of people in the system. Oh, here's one that should have been, what's going on here? Which is just a nightmare. But if the classic one, I mean, you work in a big enterprise, you've got literally hundreds of systems with thousands of users per system, and all of them can get drug into scope or whatever the audit is. And you mentioned SOX, but when you're talking about like a SOC 2, it could be much deeper than SOC 2, all kinds of systems. And when there'd be an Oracle user, right, back when you didn't have IDMs or IEPs, and so you had Oracle accounts within that domain, and hey, this person left 2 months ago, and they still have an account on there. Who gives a damn? Now, nobody likes to hear that, but who cares? You can't even get to the prompt to try to log in unless you've, in those days, walked through the door, VPN in, multi-factor, all this stuff. It's sloppy.
Yep.
I don't like it. Yep. But it's disingenuous to put in a report that there's open access that someone can still have because it's just not true.
Yeah. Well, so keep it. Here's my takeaway for that particular finding. The finding isn't that you still have access on this, that somebody can use that access.
Mm-hmm.
The finding is more about, let me look at your offboarding processes in general.
Yep. Your sloppiness. Absolutely.
Well, yes. Let me tell you how I tackle that one and see what you think about this, right? So, and look, it's an audit. So you know what it said. It went against your policy. And your policy said when people leave, we offboard them within 48 hours or 24 hours or 2 hours, whatever it was. And they said, well, you said this and you didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed it. And this is what I recommend to people now. Is we split the authenticators into primary authenticators and secondary. And the primary are the ones you need to access things externally, the ones that you could externally access with. And the secondary are all the other ones. And by policy, we change to that 2 hour, 10 minute, whatever it's going to be, only on the primaries. And on the secondaries, we said, we'll do batch-based 30-day cleanouts. And so we're totally within the policy if it takes 30 days to clean out. It's hygiene, but it's not going to lead to a compromise tonight. So let's not get burned on audit.
Yeah, and that sort of batch, like just purge things that have, like the use it or lose it sort of approaches that many of us take, and is a great way to say, you know what, look, my technical capabilities don't enable me to offboard as efficiently as I'd like, but we have this fallback compensating control, and the auditors are like, okay, great, good enough, move on.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of passkeys, this is something that I spent a lot of time on recently, and I wanted to float by you guys. So honestly, I'm going to pivot us over to this. First of all, quick question. Are both of you guys running into and making use of passkeys on a regular basis now?
I am. My issue is I have three stores for passkeys. Yeah. My computer. I have four. My computer, my personal password manager, and my company password manager. Okay. And so what I would
love... And your phone, is that number four?
And my phone would be my fourth one, yes. Yeah. And I would love to just be able to say, I just would rather just pick one place where that's determined. But that's it. It's better than what we have before. It's just right now, I think we have to figure out, how do we have these three or four different systems just recognize which passkey to use? Because right now my passkey's in some cases all of them, and other cases only in one of them.
Or three or four, and you won't know until you find out the hard way.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so the reason this came up for me is that I've been availing myself of passkey technology since it became available, and I see forward-leaning apps that take advantage of it and allow it. And like in the model that you mentioned, if you have a corporate password manager, and if you have like managed device requirements, no BYOD, then you could do that. You say, okay, we're going to have pass keys, but you have to, and via technical control, you have to store them only in these certain areas, in these certain enclaves, right? Because you could only even get to the site to issue it with a managed device anyway, and then you would have the whatever the password manager is set up. But for the other 99% of companies that do have some mix of BYOD, and for every company that can actually lock down and say you can only log into Postgres from a company device, there's 1,000 companies who still allow you to get to email, OneDrive, Slack, all this other stuff. So for all intents and purposes, the majority of access for most companies is available from outside the corporate walls. And so in those cases, the passkeys are going all over the place, to your point. But I don't think that it's the end of the world. We should just kill it. I think we should just understand it. So I started mapping out the flow, because for me, I do put passkeys on my phone sometimes, and I think it's wonderful. I was at this offsite, and a startup founder, I was showing him what I was doing. This was wild. This was like a watershed moment for me in technology. So this startup founder, we were really just hitting it off, and I was telling him what I'm doing, and he's doing it. Sounds awesome. And I said, let me just show you. And we were at a dinner, and I didn't have my laptop. He did. And I said, go to our website here, and we have a Zero Trust gateway over it that I had to log into. So here's that moment. Am I going to lean over on his laptop and type in my name and password? Like, who would do that? That's awful, right? But I passkeyed it, and it sent up a QR code up, and I scanned it with my phone. And I acted, and he, in essence, logged in on his laptop. He was kind enough to kill the session in front of me and all that afterwards, okay? But it was the first time I ever was able to do something like that because of the technology. In order to be able to do that, and then I was storing it on my phone. And having dissected all this, storing on the phone can be similar to storing on the computer, which means in today's day and age, it's generally going to be stored on a trusted processing module, a TPM.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is a misnomer, right? The not the name, but the it's not stored on it. It's generated on it, right? Mm-hmm. It never leaves the enclave, the private key, like an HSM. Yeah. It's wonderful, and it just uploads the public part, which is wonderful. But on my phone, and probably most people in the Apple ecosystem, it's actually storing it on the iCloud keychain.
Yeah.
So now, and when I first learned about these, as I'm reading the description, I think, oh, it's only on my device. That sucks. I can't ever use that. And then, you could store them in a keychain. My first thought is, yay, now these are actually usable. My second thought was, they're syncing all over the place, the security concern. So I feel like you have to be able to sync them, but how do you do it securely? And what I ultimately did, and I think that companies are going to have to do this now, is come up with like a passkey policy. And like in our case, TPMs on machines that you control are okay. And if you're going to do it on a keychain, or a password manager, or Chrome, it's all the same problem, Bitwarden, whatever, then that interface has to be protected with two hard tokens, right? But unless you draw out the whole map of what can allow access to what, that lets access to what, I think we're just setting ourselves up for some blind spots where people are going to walk all over this.
And then, you know, if you start enforce, I mean, if you try to manage it as a company, let's say your employees' phones, smartphones, invariably you're going to have to get into the MDM world, or at least talk about it. And it's very costly because you're going to have to start enforcing. Right now, you're like, oh, you should have, thou shalt have a strong password to authenticate to your phone. Thou shalt do X. And how do you ensure that that's, you know, that's happening? And so, and then if you're trying to do business, like, for example, what's that healthcare? I forget the compliance thing up in the UK for National Institute of Health. And now, even let's say that you are a vendor to the National Institute of Health.
NHS, National Health Service.
That's right. That's right. Thank you. Sir. Thank you for correcting me. So there's this thing called Cyber Essential Plus. Have you folks ever heard of this thing? Okay. So Cyber Essential Plus was like started wringing its ugly hands last year. And basically what the agency said was, yes, you're providing me a service where all my data is in a different confined cloud. It has nothing to do with your own email services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we're going to take into consideration your email, maybe your CRMs, even though they might not have any information about my company. We're going to include them as part of the footprint. And if you're using smart devices that you're allowing you to bring your own device via phones, you're going to need to do MDMs. Imagine having to have that discussion with a company and how costly MDMs are.
It's stupid.
What about having a conversation with your CFO where you're telling the CFO, hey, you know, that thing I didn't budget for, I'm going to need to buy phones for everybody, company phones. It's going to cost $5 to $10 million. That's just a sticker shock. Imagine having to manage them as well.
Oh, the culture shock. I mean, how can you? Oh. MDM is stupid, and this is perpetrated by people who invested in it. Sorry. There, I said it. MDM is a farce. Company-issued phones are worse. Everybody who has a company-issued phone doesn't use it. They use their real phone when they're at the pool.
Yeah.
But the company has plausible deniability because they told them to use the corporate one. It's not real security. Yeah. And the MDMs, it's really dumb because we're so worried about malware on the mobile device and that then they can get to the TPM. And like, nah, the threat intel doesn't support that. Sorry. You know? Go bareback on the phone, no MDM, let the thing just run and use the TPM, have passkeys on it. And there has not been any incidents that I've heard of that exploit that kill chain.
So I agree on the phone side. Are you suggesting MDM on devices?
I was afraid you were going to say that. Yeah. Well, you remember, I mean, we're old. MDM was only phones until 6 years ago. And now all of a sudden you're like, oh, shit, you're talking about laptops? I'm sorry. How many times do you have that conversation? Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater in the context of MDM for devices.
Well, MDM for devices, for laptops,
is
really just saying it's the new version of corporate managed devices. It's just like, so I get that. It's like trying to drag us back to at least having a corporate issued device.
Mm. Yeah. The idea, again, I'm going to push back on this, that it's the same agencies that wanting us to do things like Cyber Essential Plus that also demand privacy of the employees, especially in Europe.
Yeah.
So you start running this MDM. What do you think you're going to do? You're going to, I'm going to monitor all these things you're running and what traffic's you're going. Oh, my goodness. You're in the privacy world. You might get a lawsuit by your employees in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me offer corporate issued devices is a throwback as well. Right. I mean, think about the Chromebook model, or rather, why would any corporate data have to reside on that endpoint at all to begin with, or why should it? All right. And to the degree that we can avoid that being a scenario altogether is what we would also shoot for. I think that's why the secure browser companies are interesting as well, because they can create those enclaves of data within your environment, regardless of what endpoint that you're using.
Yeah, I'm bullish on that, definitely. Because I also think when it comes to data security, we're so overfixated on some structured data we know about, like these stupid SSNs that we just blew up a minute ago. And in reality, it's the conversations that are the most sensitive. right? Mm-hmm. The Slacks and God forbid the Jira. I mean, and then not just for the stuff, the products you're going to do, but for the fixes to what? To this problem that isn't fixed yet. Like, ooh, you don't want that out there. And there's no regex looking for problems that we don't want leaked out. And nobody cares about that stuff when they think about MDM and DLP. And it's like, oh, that's just communication. That doesn't count. You could use that on whatever you want. We're just protecting the database queries. And I think in today's world, that's not where the data is. It's not in the database.
Well, let me offer an interesting perspective on that. There's no regex query that says, tell me all the data that we don't want to leak out in terms of vulnerabilities that we haven't patched or issues that we haven't resolved.
Corporate plan, strategy, and all that, yeah.
But there is a new, there's a new emerging language that is pretty flexible than regex that's allowing us to actually find things much more elegantly. And it's the hottest programming language out there. It's called English. And these large language models, when you stick a whole bunch of data that you've found either through compromises or whatever, you throw it in there, and an attacker goes in and says, hey, go look for this type of content. Uh-huh. And boom, there you go.
Or it's even worse. You could just, the attacker could prompt, look through this data and tell me if there's anything I should be interested in.
No, exactly. Right. That's my point. There's a huge amount of toil from the attacker standpoint of having to sift through stuff, and the opportunity costs of that relative to, okay, let me just regex the things that I know I'm looking that I can find, like tokens or whatever else it might be, versus things that are of much greater business value, but you have to spend the time to sift through them. And if you had a tool to be able to do that, then you can see how attackers could be empowered to make use of that more.
You know, as I think about that, the data itself is not as valuable as rather how you're using that data, that it's even more valuable. So I've talked to a lot of hedge funds in the past, and all of them have the same data. They gather data from different places. What they guard heavily is those schemas that are taking, you know, how they're leveraging that data and the processes. So that's what they consider to be at times the keys to the kingdom. So I would agree with Jerry. Sometimes the data itself is not as a, well, I mean, a lot of agreement today with you, Jerry, but I would tend to agree with that whole, you know, the data itself is not as important.
I'll get you to come around on the ransoms too. We could horse trade on that.
No.
So speaking about whether or not people are looking in the right places for the problems, one last thing I wanted to, that has come up a lot. And so I'm not unlike you guys in a bunch of Slack workspaces. It's just insane. And a lot of them are security practitioners. And something I've seen come up a lot lately are a lot of security leaders are asking, hey, someone asked me about doing a outside assessment, right? Boards love that. Any kind of third party loves seeing an independent assessment of the program. And I think it's good news that those are starting to converge on a playbook, which is generally a NIST CSF-based maturity assessment. Right. If you go back 10 years, there was a billion different standards. Every big four had their own, too, because they were trying to lock you in, because how the hell do you do trending over years unless you do the same apples-to-apples assessment? And they all dug in their heels about doing stuff against NIST CSF. I remember that from personal experience, because they knew that would lower your switching costs, and then you could use anybody. But we got past it somehow, and now that's what's on sale. It's expensive, $250,000 a lot, to do one of these assessments. And the question that comes up is, I mean, beyond, hey, have you worked with X or Y and how are they, is are these valuable? Are they accurate? Is it going to make the board pull on the right threads here or not? I certainly have my opinions on it. How about you guys?
Okay, so history lesson. Before I was at Bank of America, I was at Booz Allen. And at Booz Allen back in 2010-ish or so, we were running these assessments against a framework that we created at the time. Mm-hmm. We created this framework, and the framework consisted of five functions: prepare, prevent, detect, respond, recover. Okay? So we created this new framework a few years before even NIST came up with theirs, right? We actually submitted this to NIST and said, hey, this is something that you should consider as part of the CSF. And we did this assessment for a lot of different customers. It was, let's just say it was very lucrative.
Yeah.
Okay. And at the end of the day, it was interesting because how the board chose to use it was to, they love the outside view, but they were at the end, at some level in some organizations, they were using it to get rid of the existing leadership in the security team. In other words, they needed some sort of outside evidence to say, here's why we need some change.
Wow.
In other cases, when it was sponsored by the CISO, it was just to, again, reaffirm, yes, we're doing a great job. When it was done within the CISO organization, it gave them also ammunition to go and take action against some members of some leadership within their organization as well. So in other words, it was all to be able to, in some respects, I can't say this is all the case, but there were political maneuvers, if you will, to change staff, to replace team members, or whatever else it might be. And so that's something that there is some value in that, if you need that evidence or that ammunition. It also points at lack of will, lack of courage to make some of these decisions on your own. But it does help when you have an outside perspective that says, hey, here's what an outside person says. I wish I could say this was useful in the context of saying just that because we've been in this maturity assessment, you've actually now know what you need to do with it to move forward. But I've also just in general soured on maturity assessments overall. Why? Because I can take, well, when you do this at scale with many different companies, you realize they all look the same year after year. Okay. It doesn't matter how much energy you put into it. The maturity, where you are in your maturity progression and where you want to be, it's like it's all the same.
I'm going to push back on this. I don't know if I want to pay $250,000 for a maturity assessment, but let me bring it back to like our everyday life events. Okay. I don't know if any of you have teenagers that are going to be driving soon. Okay. And exactly, me too. So I think we all probably experience our insurance are going to spike up once our new teenagers are going to start driving this. Well, it could be used as a weapon if you don't know how to use it, right? You can hurt somebody. And so a lot of the studies have, at least in the insurance industry, have demonstrated that a lot of these newer drivers tend to get into accidents. So there's a higher risk that there's something going to happen, and thus the insurance will put more higher premiums. Why can we say the same thing about a control in a company, a security control? If it's a newer control, one that is heavily either manual, requires a lot of manual interaction and training, well, one could argue that there's probably a lot of potential for misconfiguration, Sunil. Back to our misconfiguration topic. Isn't that a good way of assessing your company's probability of having an error? I'll leave that open to you guys.
Well, complexity adds room for error, right? So the simpler the control, the simpler it is to operate. It's like, going back to the car example, I think it's Rivians that have, one pedal control, right? You lift your foot off the brake and it starts to brake. Sorry, you lift your foot off the gas and it starts to brake. Yeah, and it's just because of regenerative braking, right? So it reduces the possibility of pressing the wrong button or whatever else it might be, right?
I would say AWS. I mean, the previous slide we had about AWS a couple of slides ago, isn't that the same point? You start using this really powerful AWS environment. It's got secure by default, but you're new to that AWS environment. You don't have the training and you make mistakes. Isn't that the same?
Well, when it comes to security controls and all, security controls generally as a principle tend to make things more complex to begin with.
Yeah.
So we're actually adding complexity by adding security controls. That's why I also really advocate for DIE as a principle, DIE, distributed, immutable, ephemeral, because it helps us offset the need for security controls at all.
Yeah.
And that actually makes the environment much simpler. When it comes to these assessments, though, and how you go in and assess it, so just as much as Jerry keeps hampering on the ransomware bans, I would say we should ban maturity assessments.
Right?
because maturity itself is such a crutch word, and it's such a meaningless word in my view. How mature are you is not a, it's just a poorly defined sort of concept. Mm-hmm. And so in how I've described it, for example, so in my book, Cyber Defense Matrix, I use the word maturity a total of exactly 0 times.
Wow.
Okay. And that was intentional, because what I wanted to do was, instead of declaring what is more mature, I just wanted to be able to say, let me just measure where you are in any spectrum, okay? Whether you could determine this measurement to be, quote, mature, that's up to you. I don't really care. But you may choose to say, when you're this tall, yes, you're now mature and you can drive.
Yep.
Or I don't care if you're even this tall, you're not going to be able to drive because you have no understanding of how to operate those controls, okay? But at the very least, I can say you're at least this tall.
I think your argument about maturity assessment is that today the vast majority are left for subjective interpretation. And if we could be more objective about them, maybe there's a better way of measuring. I would agree with you, Sunil. Mm-hmm. A lot of these maturity assessments are left for the auditor to say, hey, man, why am I a 3? I should be a 4. I don't agree with you. I'm not a 3 or a 2. Look what I've done. So I think you might be onto something. But I still like maturity assessments if they're done objectively.
Well, so getting back to that, right? One of the things I like to rail on when I'm talking about cybersecurity is home appraisals. You see where I'm coming with this in a second. I remember it had been many years since I had had a buy or sell a home, and I was somewhere in the middle of this and I had to get an appraisal for something, and the appraiser came along and said, you know, what's the contract price? You know, and I said, well, I don't want to tell you. You know, that kind of leads the witness. They said, I can't do an appraisal unless I know the target. That's real. It's awful. Yeah. And so back to your point about maturity assessments, if you would come in and sorry, I shouldn't just call out your example because it's going to mislead people into thinking that these words are coming out of your mouth. But if you come in from a Big Four consultancy and the team is thinking, all right, we want things to come up bad because we want to get rid of this person. That's a total mistake. That's not the way it can be. And likewise, the CISO can't come in and say, oh, I want to show how good we're doing, so I'm going to pick the maturity assessment, all that. And I used to say this, that you have tests, exams, audits, whatever they may be, that you want to pass and ones that you want to fail. And I always use the example of, like, your SOC 2 report, you want to pass it. Sorry, it's just true. You're not commissioning a SOC 2 report to get to the bottom of things, figure out what you need to fix. Red team is on the other end of the spectrum. If you don't find anything there, you want your money back, right? You go nuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying these maturity assessments need to be the ones you want to fail. And I think culturally, everyone has to go into it. And the way that manifests is telling the whole team, because that's what they're going to interview, right? They're going to talk to your team members for days. And to tell them all, hey, gloves are off here. Be completely transparent. You know, don't go the poor guys that came up in eDiscovery on Tim Brown's team that were always, oh, we're awful about everything and all that. Don't Eeyore it. But, you know, show them the real firewall that actually governs the right packets and all that kind of stuff. And if everybody agrees to that, then you actually have something. And I think the other really critical fun part of it is, so these maturity systems, you end up with a spider chart, right? Whatever framework you use, you see it around there. And on each thing, you see whether you're doing 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And it's useless without a target, right? And the target shouldn't be set after you do the maturity assessment. It should be set before you do the assessment. And it's not a cybersecurity thing. It's a CEO thing, president thing, CFO, GC. And yeah, you walk through, here's where resiliency matters. Let's say you're talking about resiliency. Maybe it's ransomware. And we're worried about ransomware. Yeah, you know, most companies take 3 or 4 weeks. If we have a high resiliency score, it might show that we actually could be back in 1 week. And I say, 4 weeks, you know, it's unlikely to happen anyway. It's very expensive. And all right, if we land at a 2.0 out of 5 there, that's okay. But maybe somewhere else, detection or something like that. And it's easy to say that you want to be perfect on everything. But where your bones are made is in with management agreeing on the areas that you want to have low. And I remember specifically delivering this is fun. I remember delivering a maturity assessment up to the board and someone saying, wait a minute, you're saying that that target is below where we are? Are you saying that you want to go backwards? I said, no, let's, you know, by all means, if all things are equal, let's outperform. But I'm saying I'm not going to be upset about it until we fall down below this level. And those are the tough discussions, but I think they're essential. All right, guys. Well, this is fun as always. Thanks a lot. And I'm looking forward to speaking to you next time.